Well, I feel the weight of opening up these two topics tonight. Two topics, so that's poetry on the one hand and loss on the other. Two topics that I think I can say people generally fear. Poetry, on the one hand, can have this aura around it, this intimidating aura that makes us think we need to kind of say it like this, poetry. Mm-hmm. And loss, as well, is a topic we avoid. We don't really want to go there. How many times have we heard someone say something like, I don't mean to be morbid, or not to be morbid, before they begin to talk about this topic? So both of these we approach with trepidation. Maybe you already feel a little discomfort in the room. Anybody want to own up to that? Interestingly, I wonder if these two, so poetry and grief or loss, can make us uncomfortable for similar reasons. Poems, as I've already alluded to, or there's kind of this air around poetry that says you're in or you're out. Either you get it or you don't get it. And a lot of people feel like they're in the camp of I don't get it. In fact, I've had a lot of people explicitly say that to me. Oh, poems, you like poetry? I don't get it. So there's this kind of the haves and the have-nots when it comes to poetry. The me versus you, or the us versus them. And loss, too. There can be this attitude of either you've known tragedy, and so you have a right to go there, or you haven't. And this kind of shuts people up. It shuts down the conversation and means we don't talk about it. We're afraid to talk about it. We humans love to compare. Even our sufferings. And in grief or in loss, there can be this attitude of where the comparisons can go a couple of ways. It can be a sort of, you have no idea what I've suffered, which is still a me versus you attitude. Or, I'm hurting, I'm feeling sad, but I haven't suffered like fill in the blank. It's often Job or someone like that. So it's still this me versus you, us versus them. And how destructive to our already sore hearts, especially when we're talking about loss. So I want to just dispel some of that fear right at the beginning. I want to knock down this dichotomy right here at the start that says either you get it or you don't. Either you've known loss or you haven't. Who's in, who's out? And I'd rather just replace that with a word of welcome to everyone who's here. You are welcome here, each of you. And all of our varied experiences that have traveled here with us. So whether you read and love poetry, or you're generally suspicious towards poetry and try to avoid words like stanza and simile and sestina, either way, you're welcome here. Whether you have known tragedy or feel like you're bracing for it because it hasn't come quite yet, I want you to know you're welcome in this discussion. Please don't hear me saying, therefore, that all loss is equal. I'm definitely not saying that, but rather there's room here tonight in this discussion and in these poems. We're going to make room for lament, which I was so glad was one of Mary Frances's words of wisdom last week. She was lecturing on the Me Too movement, and one of her bits of advice at the end was, one of the things we need to do is to lament. We need to make room for sadness and anger and a sense of this is not the way things are supposed to be. So I hope to make room for some lament tonight through these poems. All of us in this room have known loss of some sort, ranging from the loss of an object, right? Who hasn't frantically searched their house for that photo or that trinket or that piece of jewelry or that letter, whatever it is? Ranging from that loss to the loss of a job, the loss of a pet, the loss of a dream, the loss of your health, the loss of a friendship, the loss of romance, the loss of trust, the loss of a season of life, which is something I think we particularly do not grieve well. I'd love to see us make more room for that. The loss of singleness. We don't often talk about that right before people get married. The loss of a home. Or, of course, the unique and terrible loss experienced in death. So whichever of these you have known, you're welcome here. And I'm convinced that the poems we're going to look at are a really good place to bring your loss. So whenever I talk about poetry in a setting like this, I feel like it's important to break up the earwax. It's the image in my mind to help us hear poems, especially if you're used to people kind of being like poetry in that way I mentioned earlier. So to help us, I like to start with these false assumptions, three false assumptions. I got these from Edward Hirsch. He wrote a book called How to Read a Poem and Fall in Love with Poetry. It's a bestseller. But these are taken from an article that's kind of shortening that book, paraphrasing it. I think these are a great way to start talking about poems together and to recognize that these assumptions can rob us of the gifts that poems have to give us. So, number one. Remember, these are false assumptions. Number one, you should understand perfectly on the first reading. And if not, something is wrong with you or the poem. So if I re-say that positively, it's okay if you don't perfectly understand in the first reading. The poet Malcolm Guite said to me a couple years ago, "Who wants to go out with a poem that gives you everything on the first date?" Good word to keep in mind. So it's okay if you don't understand everything. Number two, the poem is a code, and unless you can decode word for word and crack this code, you will miss the point. I think this is an easy way to teach poetry, and so unfortunately we've probably heard something like this maybe in like high school literature classes. It's easier to teach it like this, like it's an extremely difficult puzzle, or reading poetry is all about careful dissection. But I don't think that's a great way to enter a poem and enjoy its gifts, nor does it honor the craft very well. So, said positively, there's no secret code to crack, though likely there are things to learn about the craft of poetry. And number three, the poem can mean anything you want it to mean. I think this is kind of funny to contrast with number two, which makes it sound like you have to get down and get all the details just right, and then maybe you could understand it. This one is more like, well, it can kind of mean whatever you want it to mean. So, re-said positively, the poem means something. Come to these three poems stressing that tonight. The poem means something intended by the author that we can discover. So, there are some tools for you. I don't love having a slide, so that's why I made it look like a book. You see that? So there's going to be a lot of blank slides so that there's not always words up there. Is that okay? Was anybody copying that or anything? You're good. Okay, so those are some tools for us before we read these together. Now we'll get to what is kind of the central question in this lecture. It's going to get a little more specific, but here's the question I really want to ask myself and you all and many poets. Why is it that humans again and again turn to poetry in their most intense moments in life? So, for example, in religious conversions, there is a lot of poetry about conversion. A lot of them are put to music and they're hymns. And we sing them, expressed in countless hymns, our religious conversions. How many times has there been some iteration of, I once was blind, but now I see? I wonder how many times that's been kind of used and changed throughout history. So that's one example of our intense moments. probably the one that immediately came to mind was, of course, love poetry, right? Honestly, okay, be really honest. How many of you in this room have at some point written a love poem? Come on, come on. Some point in your life. Not every single person, I'm surprised. Most people. Shortly after I met Dave, I wrote a poem about Dave. And it was kind of, the imagery was kind of like God was this artist painting this picture of my life, and somehow Dave was being painted in. And it was very surprising. In fact, just to break the ice, I'm going to read it for you. I'm just kidding. There's no way I'm going to read that for you. I'm not going to read that. I'm totally kidding. I'm not going to. I was never planning on that. It was just a joke. I like to think of wedding vows, too, as kind of this, like, this height of love poetry. It's this rhythmic repetition that says not only I'm beginning to feel this way, but I'm making vows in this direction. And of course, every pop song for forever gives witness to this. We like to put our experiences of love or falling in love to rhyme or to lyric. And then of course, where we're landing tonight, also in grief, in sorrow. Something, some sense within us tells us that we do well in these intense moments to find a poem or to make one. And personally, I am very interested in this. Why does our grief, our sorrows, our experiences of loss turn us toward poetry? I hope you already have some ideas churning. I would really love to hear them. Isn't it compelling that in times that are usually very chaotic in our interior lives, in the shock of loss, in the ache of grief, we reach out, in these chaotic times, we reach out for a very structured art form? What does that mean? What's going on there? Jesus, the Messiah, in his darkest hour, abandoned, in agony, tortured, mocked, seemingly forgotten, on the verge of death, turned to a poem. On the cross, he quoted Psalm 22. Matthew records this for us, so does Mark. And I've read multiple commentators who say this could be a way the gospel writer is telling us he quoted the entire psalm. It's kind of like a way of noting this is the title of the psalm, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? But he may have quoted the whole thing. And to a lesser degree, but in my own experiences of loss, I have turned to poems. There seems to be a hospitable space inside some poems toward loss, toward pain, toward sorrow. Ben, one of our colleagues, Ben Kai, said a few weeks ago, he was doing a lecture on gratitude, and he was talking about gratitude journals. He wasn't necessarily saying they're a bad idea. He just said that sometimes it's a practice of think on the good things only. And that could be unhelpful. And I love that poetry does not do that. There is a lot of room in poetry to think on the not so good things. It is an art form that has long been a place for loss and pain and sorrow, all the way back to ancient elegies, dirges, the Psalms, of course. Jewish and Christian scriptures are filled with expressing loss in poetic lines. Humans have been putting pain to rhyme and meter and crafting it into something new for a very long time. There's a line from a particular ancient poem that gets repeated, at least in the West, over and over and over again to describe our experiences, our sufferings, our griefs, our loss. I wish there was some kind of database where I could look up how many times this has been referenced in the last 10 years, even in like pop culture. See if you can finish the phrase. The valley of the shadow of death. Obviously, this phrase resonates with people. and it's from Psalm 23, and often is recited at funerals, which is another question we could carry for a long while. Why are poems so often our choice at funerals? So I just want us to start by acknowledging that our sorrows seem to find a home in poems. I have three more examples of this before we get to our poems, and they're just small little things I've come across. I've come across many, many examples of people turning to poetry in times of great loss or sorrow, but these three were particularly compelling to me in the last few weeks. The first one is from a guy named Mark. He's a poet. Mark Doty. And is anybody familiar with the website? Is it poetryfoundation.org? Yep, it's a great website connected to the Poetry Magazine. Lots of great resources there. They held a forum for a time called Can Poetry Console a Grieving Public? I think that's what it was called. And it was largely a reflection on 9/11. Mm-hmm. And I was reading one of these articles. I was reading one of these articles, and one of the guys had this to say. I was out of the country that whole fall of 9/11, and so I don't have the same connection to the video footage and all the news that many Americans heard and experienced that fall, but I thought this was super compelling. The staff at Barnes & Noble in Union Square told me that the store was entirely empty in the days immediately following the fall of the towers, save for the poetry section. I'm not going to comment on these three examples I've given to you much. I just kind of want them to be fuel for our discussion. I find that very compelling. The second example is from Edward Hirsch, the guy who I got the three false assumptions from. He has written in the last few years a 50-page elegy, which is like a mourning poem. His 22-year-old son, I believe, died of a drug overdose, and he wrote this 50-page long poem to honor him and to grieve. And he said he hasn't said a lot about it. I mean, you can read it. It's called Gabriel, or Gabriel, a poem. But he did say this in a... Oops, I went in the wrong order. That's okay. In an interview. I found a comfort in trying to solve some poetic problems, because there were human ones I just couldn't solve. I think that gets repeated in different ways in things we'll discuss a little later. In his case, writing poems, giving form to something, working on what he calls the problems, or the craft of poetry, helped express his grief, helped him mourn, gave him something to do, brought him some comfort. And the last one is from John Lithgow. Do you know who he is right off the bat, if you know famous people? He's an actor, he's a comedian, he's a poet. I know him from Third Rock from the Sun. That's what he was on when I was growing up. He was an alien in that TV show. But he's actually, yeah, a really thoughtful guy who loves poetry and has published this book, a collection of poetry, kind of an introduction to poetry called The Poet's Corner. That's excellent. And Dave showed me this. In the preface, he talks about this magical night where he was invited to come and speak at a benefit for parents of children with autism. Mm-hmm. And all the poems were expressing their struggles, their suffering, their grief. And yeah, you'll see what he has to say about it. It's remarkable. This is by the time he got through the poems. Everyone in the hall was in tears, myself included. I'd never performed for an audience like that. I could sense a kind of electricity in the air. Every word of these poems was intensely meaningful to them, speaking to their deepest feelings. They felt connected to the poets. The connection was startling, exhilarating, and comforting to them. Poetry can do that. This is a beautiful example of poetry helping you not to feel alone in your grief, and in your sorrow. So keep these in mind. We can come back to them if you'd like later. But this turning to poetry in our dark hours is worth our investigation, and it might end up even giving gifts to us in our sorrows. Often the reason people give to why this is so, why people turn to poetry, is the need to express. That happened to come to anybody's mind so far, that we need to express our pain. I like that word. Express means to squeeze out, right? X out, press out. It's a good word, and I think yes and amen to that. But I think we can also travel a little deeper together to try and discern why this connection between poetry and grief. So that's my hope as we begin with our first poem. Remember, it's okay if you don't catch everything. We will discover together. The way I like to do poetry in a setting like this is that I will first read it to you before you see it on the screen. So you can take a deep breath if you want, close your eyes if you want. That's what I often recommend. And then I will read it. And when I'm done, I'll bring it up on the screen, and then you'll have time to read it again for yourself. So this first poem is called Names. Names.
Names.
She was Eliza for a few weeks when she was a baby, Eliza Lilly. Soon it changed to Lil. Later she was Miss Steward in the baker's shop, and then my love, my darling, mother. Widowed at 30, she went back to work as Mrs. Hand. Her daughter grew up, married, and gave birth. Now she was Nana. Everybody calls me Nana, she would say to visitors, and so they did. Friends, tradesmen, the doctor. In the geriatric ward, they used the patient's Christian names. Lil, we said, or Nana. But it wasn't in her file, and for those last bewildered weeks, she was Eliza once again. This is a poem by Wendy Cope. She's a living author. She's English. I especially like this poem because she's known for her comedy, for her comic poetry, for her parodies and her limericks. Turning like very sacred poetry into limericks is kind of her gig. But this is not that. This is a true story. It is about her grandmother. It is, of course, a poem about a woman's whole life, the whole span of her life. It's about her growing old, it's about her getting sick, and ultimately dying. There's no formal structure to this poem. It's not a sonnet, it's not a ballad, there's no rhymes that I can find, at least. That doesn't mean it's structureless. But I chose it because it's a scanty poem. It's very sparse. It's brief. You can hardly believe a woman's entire life has been told in 17 lines. And yet it feels like it's well told, even though it's through the lens of her, what she was called, her names. I chose it to illustrate one of the richest things about poetry that I can find. Alyssa and I have talked about this a little bit. A lot of people who write, a lot of writers talk about the blank page, right? And how intimidating that is, how terrifying that is, and this job to fill it. Well, the job of a poet is much more related to leaving it blank than filling it up. Poetry is largely about absences, what you leave out, what you don't say. You can even look at it on the page and feel that. There's a lot of blank space on this poem. So I like to think of poetry as like a handling of absences. Like making a presence, right? This poem is a present thing by handling all that is absent. Keeping all of that out, essentially. Just as a little exercise, I wanted to compare this to a page of prose. Do you feel the difference? That's just stuff I cut and pasted from somewhere. You don't want to, it's nothing worth reading. They'll think. Look at that difference. It's the same font size. I mean, same font, same size. So the job of a poet is often to carry absences well. And I think that resonates with our experiences of loss. That when we're in grief or we are working through some sort of loss, we're carrying this absence with us and we feel that resonating in a poem. I brought up this idea to a fellow poet and he reminded me of a poem I love, I have used before in a lecture. It's a poem by Wendell Berry called How to Be a Poet. Is that familiar to anyone? It's called How to Be a Poet, to Remind Myself. It's too long to share the whole thing with you, but the last stanza, I think, will shed some light on this idea of carrying absence. So I wanted to share it with you. That's not it. He says, accept what comes from silence. Make the best you can of it, of the little words that come out of the silence like prayers prayed back to the one who prays. Make a poem that does not disturb the silence from which it came. So good, Wendell Berry. So this careful making, it's interesting. I mean, if we had some more time to spend on this, he's talking about making words, making something with words, and yet he's talking about it coming from silence, which is compelling. And similar to what I'm trying to say, that we make, that a poem is something present, something you're encountering in the present, and yet it's full of absence. And that can resonate with us. So let's go back to I think I put it here. Yep. So those are some of my thoughts on this poem. I'd love to just open it up to things you want to draw out, phrases you think really sing, questions you might have. I may not be able to answer, but I'll try. And just to have us interact with this poem a little bit. So,
I think she does a good job of talking about the seasons of Eliza's life through the names that she's called.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes, Mary Frances. And then Danny.
I was struck by when you read it, first in hearing it, it felt like a sort of a distant narrator. And then I wasn't sure I caught it then, but when I read it again, the last stanza, Lil, we said,
yeah.
I wasn't sure, and there's this, to me, that was just like, oh, it was like just a shift of who's telling the story, and it's so much more personal, and it's not somewhat objective talking about
the scope of this woman's life over here. There's this very personal connection. And then it makes the loss at the end much more personal. And even the loss of her name.
Yes.
The familiarity of her name. Yeah. So much more, there's so much more weight to that.
Yeah, it's really masterfully done that you only find the we, you know, four lines from the bottom. Danny?
Yeah, I was just thinking about how, like you said, it's so short that you get an idea of her whole life.
Yeah.
I guess part of that, what's helpful here is like the, or one of the things, I guess, is that like the word weeks, and then she was Eliza, that phrase returns, is sort of like bookend.
Wow, yeah. She was Eliza, she was Eliza.
Her life. I don't know, it kind of encapsulates
her. That's good. I hadn't noticed those exact three words. Yes, Dick.
I don't know what to make of it quite, but it seems that the different names she's named, the title is the name, or name. It's obviously name is what it's all about.
Yeah.
Seems the names for her seem largely dictated by other people and their relationship to, or their need, or their whatever.
Yeah.
Now that could either be a criticism, or some to think of a depersonalization about seeing her, or else the fact that she was really a person for others.
Yeah.
But it is interesting that her name that comes up is what worked for other people.
Yeah.
To call her.
That's a good point. And yet it's her voice we hear in the middle. Yeah. Everybody calls me Nana.
Yeah.
So she's owning that, at least that one title. Yes, Nicole.
I think not only how short the poem is as a whole, but also like how quickly the author runs off my love, my darling mother. Is such a good representation of how quickly life passed by.
Yeah.
How she just captivates that so well.
Yeah. So good. Yeah, Kai.
I don't know the word for it, but I love that the only like unnecessary word is bewildered. It just really shows how she's feeling and how the family must have felt like watching that happen. Like other than that, it's exactly as it happened. It's exactly like word for word. There are a few adjectives.
Yeah.
And it just laughs bewildered, but you hear this like hopelessness.
Yeah. You were going to say something about that?
I was going to comment on that as well. Like, that really leapt out to me. And I thought of, you know, sort of even thinking of it as a remembrance poem of a person, or an elegy, or a memorial, were given to describing people. And she's really kind, she's generous, she's friendly, she's, you know, like lists and lists of adjectives.
Yeah.
And yet they aren't here.
You're right.
Like that's an absence in this poem, are adjectives. And so where an adjective does come, it hits with a greater impact. And, you know, that it's not describing her, but the passage of time and even those last weeks.
So good. Marty.
I was struck by that the phrase, but it wasn't in the file. It's sort of the only impersonal phrase, and everything else is so personal. It's relational. It's all her names have to do with relationships with people.
Yeah.
And then, but it wasn't in her file.
Yeah,
so she has to get called this name that
she's never
she doesn't
called.
Recognize. Know herself.
Yeah. We're all in agreement. The last three lines are crazy brilliant.
Yeah, they are.
Yes.
Well, I had a different. The bewilderment stuck out to me, but I had a different response. It's the only one in there, the only word that tells me directly anything about her feelings. And it made me feel like the rest of the poem was shallow.
Yeah.
I mean, everything else is I have to just imagine what it's like to be in a bake shop, or we can assume what my love, my darling mother means. That's the only one that gets at what's going on in her head. And that made me feel like it was, as I say, a shallow. Made me sad.
I have had someone else that I've shared this with say it felt to them very empty. which was so different from how I encountered the poem. But there's something in that that I agree with. There's something of, she's a lot more than this. I mean, of course, the poet knows you can't say everything in a poem, and she's chosen this lens, names, and I think she's done well with it. But I think that kind of empty feeling you get is, you can't fit a life in 17 lines in reality, you know? Yes, Max.
I think it's so beautiful. It's such a very accurate picture of how, when, you know, perhaps we're at the end of our time and we're examining our lives, what we most will identify with and remember is the names to which we were identified.
Yeah, that's a good point.
It reminded me so much of my grandparents when they were both passing, how they would talk to me about, I used to be young Don, you know, and now I'm here, I'm popping in, you know, just saying, it all goes by so quickly. And, you know, truly, even if we can't fit all of our you know, experiences and all of our memories, but, you know, truly, if, you know, what one of the things we do have is the names by which we answer to.
That's a good word. Sarah, were you going to say something?
I was just thinking, this is importing into the poem, but we don't know, you know, what was going on in the geriatric ward for her.
Yeah.
To me, I think having her identified by her relationships to people, just to me, that like sings of dementia and Alzheimer's.
Yeah.
And a loss of her identity for herself at the end of her life, and so that, you know, even the most familiar names are the ones that aren't used. And then this name that is not familiar and is further bewildering.
It's like, who's that?
It's used, like, that just seems to drive home what I imagine that experience of loss of sense of self looks like.
Yeah.
So
I haven't found anywhere that would say anything about dementia, but I imagined it the exact same way. That's what it felt like at the end, this, like, disintegration of recognition, you know? Yeah.
It also strikes me that what Max said made me think it really speaks to the shortness of life.
Yes.
I mean, that in 17 lines, and you have this woman from birth to death.
Yeah.
And it just speaks to me almost the way some of the songs do of, whoa, you know, our days are like the grass and the sun passes over and we are no more.
Boom.
But, then there's the but,
which
gives us the hope is in relationship to God, but it's kind of a morality tale in that sense. I mean, the sense of, you know, look at your life. It's, I don't know where you are. Well, Dick and I are down, not in the geriatric ward yet. We're getting down. We're definitely in the fourth stanza, and it's kind of sobering. Thinking how quickly.
Yeah, it is. It is sobering. Any other thoughts you want to offer on this poem?
I have another question.
Yes.
I can appreciate the poem. I get it. I understand it. It's certainly well written. But it does not move me. In the slightest way, it seems to have moved the rest of your audience. Is there a dearth of spirit in my heart?
Is there a what spirit?
Or am I just not into poetry?
No, I was trying to tear down that dichotomy. Yeah, I mean, I think poems will hit us differently. I'm certainly not trying to suggest each of these poems is going to move you in the same way that it might move the person next to you. But it might give you a taste to go find a poem that does move you. Okay, shall we move on to the next one? This poem is called One Art. Yes, one art.
One what?
One art. Yep, A-R-T. The art of losing isn't hard to master, So many things seem filled with the intent to be lost that their loss is no disaster. Lose something every day. Accept the fluster of lost door keys, the hour badly spent. The art of losing isn't hard to master. Then practice losing farther, losing faster, places and names and where it was you meant to travel. None of these will bring disaster. I lost my mother's watch. And look, my last or next to last of three loved houses went. The art of losing isn't hard to master. I lost two cities, lovely ones, and vaster, some realms I owned, two rivers, a continent. I missed them, but it wasn't a disaster. Even losing you, the joking voice, a gesture I love, I shan't have lied. It's evident the art of losing's not too hard to master, though it may look like, write it, like disaster.
Oh, that's Elizabeth Fisher.
This is a poem by Elizabeth Bishop. She lived from 1911 to 1979, an American poet. She is buried in Worcester, Massachusetts. I went to see her grave a couple weeks ago. 1911 to 1979. She published only 101 poems in her life. And this was her life's work. She didn't have any other job. She was a full-time poet. And she is a woman who knew terrible loss, which I think complicates the kind of bum-ba-dum-ba-dum-ba-dum feel of this poem. Her father died when she was a baby, and her mother was terribly mentally ill and was institutionalized when Elizabeth was 5, and she never saw her mother again. And was kind of passed around between families, one of whom lived in this area. So she mostly grew up around here. She taught at Harvard eventually. She won a Pulitzer. And as I said, it's very, very near here. So in contrast to the previous poem, this is a highly structured, very complex form called a villanelle. You probably felt some of that as I was reading it. You felt some of the rhyme. It is complex. And I love the idea that multiple forms can hold our grief, and I wanted to give you a taste of different forms, looser forms and more strict. And I chose this one because of that. I loved the poem, period, but I chose it because I wanted to bring our attention to giving boundaries to grief as something really wonderful that poetry on the topic can teach us. It's kind of a this far and no farther to her experience of loss. You know what I'm quoting when I say this far and no farther from Job? From the end of the book of Job. You can't do a lecture on loss and not mention Job. And by the way, a book full of poetry. God is responding to Job in the last few chapters and really kind of gives him this barrage of questions. One time I counted how many questions. Do you know, Dick? How many questions are at the
end? Depends what you count as a question. But yeah. I counted around 75.
I thought it was around 70. Yeah, there you go. It is a lot of questions. One right after the other.
Translations have different numbers of question marks.
Yep. Yeah. But at one point, you know, God is asking Job, were you there when I laid the earth's foundations? And he says, were you there when I kind of demarcated the boundaries for the sea? And throughout the scriptures, the sea is like this image of chaos, of danger, of evil, of threat, of loss even. And God tells Job that he said to the sea, this far you may come and no farther. I love that phrase. My mind goes to that phrase quite often when it comes to poetry on grief, because I think it's a practice for the poet and also for us reading it to kind of say to our experience of loss, okay, you get this space on the page, but you don't get to take over my entire life and completely define me. And when you put even greater strictures on it like this, I'm going to show you just how strict this form is. I think it's an amazing practice of giving boundaries to grief. It's a very sharply delineated expression of loss. Let me explain the villanelle to you. This might be confusing. Don't worry. It just is.
How do you spell villanelle?
You'll see. Here we go. This is a villanelle. These are the rules for a villanelle. It is a poem of 19 lines. Always a poem of 19 lines. It has 5 stanzas, each of 3 lines, and the last one has 4 lines. You can see that. 3, 3, 3, 3, 3, 4. The first line of the first stanza becomes the last line of the second and fourth stanzas. So the first line, the art of losing isn't hard to master, becomes the end here, the end of 2, and the end of 4. The third line of the first stanza, see, I can't even describe it without jumbling my words, is repeated as the last line of the third and fifth stanzas. So the third line, their loss is no disaster. She kind of plays with that one a little bit. But you can see it becomes the end of this one here. None of these will bring disaster. And then here, I missed them, but it wasn't a disaster. She mostly keeps the word disaster. The 2 refrain lines follow each other, and they become the last 2 lines of the entire poem. So they both get repeated here. The art of losing is not too hard to master, though it may look like, write it, she tells herself, like disaster. And then there is a rhyme scheme. You can see how complicated it is. It's ABA. So you can see master, intent, disaster. Fluster, spent, master. Faster, meant, disaster. Last, or, that's really smart, went, master. Faster, continent, disaster. Gesture, evident, master, disaster. So this is very hard form in which to write a poem. I have tried to write a villanelle many, many times with no success. I have nothing to show for it. It reminds me, actually, of Joshua's lecture on Lamentations. And he used the phrase, giving grief a shape, that I really loved. And I think that's what's happening here. She is giving her loss a shape, a very, with very tight reins, you might say. Now, the strictures of this form that I've just shown you might seem incongruent with loss, but I think it might be a clue, actually, a clue as to why we look to poetry in our sorrow. I've got one more thing to show you about a villanelle, and then I'd love to hear your comments. This is from a great book called The Making of a Poem. And this is just explaining a villanelle. And I think this helps us see grief in the form. Okay? Its repeated lines, the circularity of its stanzas become, as the reader listens, a repudiation of forward motion. You're not allowed to move forward. They often talk about there being no narrative to a villanelle. It refuses to have a narrative and of temporality, and therefore finally of dissolution. Each stanza of a villanelle with its refrains becomes a series of retrievals. You probably even felt that as I was reading it. I think this resonates with what grief feels like. This kind of temptation to kind of move forward and then go back, kind of move forward and then go back. Hopefully there's also some real forward movement. But I think that might be part of why it's a great form for talking about loss. There's a really famous villanelle about death. Does anyone know what it is?
Dylan Thomas.
That's right. Do not go gentle into that good night. Yeah, I didn't even mention it's usually written in iambic pentameter. That's another stricture. So it's usually 10 syllables to each line with an unstressed followed by a stressed. So think, do not go gentle into that good night. And then the other refrain is, rage, rage against the dying of the light. You don't read it like that, but that is very hard to write in. She messes with it. She does 11 in, I think, her final ones. To be lost, that there. Wait, the art of losing isn't hard to master. That's an extra syllable. I think that's kind of interesting that she plays with it a bit like that. But
does it seem like there's irony in that very first line?
Irony, yes.
No, I think there's irony.
Absolutely.
Isn't it hard to master? I mean, it's one of the hardest things that we can ever...
Yeah, I agree. Does it show that she's mastered it? I don't think so.
No.
I mean, she's trying to master this art form, but...
Except the cluster of lost door keys, but... I mean, there's depth there.
Yeah.
Do we ever come to a place of acceptance?
Of accepting loss, yeah. It's a good question. Yes?
Maybe she's saying that it's not that, like, accepting loss or like dealing with loss is particularly easy to master, but losing itself is easy in that it just sort of happens and you don't really have much control.
Like it's unavoidable.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's a the losses get more serious though,
yeah,
don't they?
Yeah,
as the
absolutely.
Poem proceeds.
That's really striking.
It's like, oh keys, and you know, once you know that little bit about her life, I lost my mother's watch. That line means a lot more. She never knew her mother. Her mother was gone.
Yeah, it almost the last stanza just seems incredibly callous.
Yeah.
You know, the loss of a person. I mean, it's obviously the most serious loss.
And yep.
That makes you think this. And actually, there is some irony. There's. It sounds like denial.
Yes. I agree. Mm. Yeah, Kai.
But I also imagine that's why she has the parenthetical writing. It might be maybe a little bit overt, but like that's her trying to be like trying to stiff upper lip and like end the poem as she wanted, because it did move her deeply. Or that's what it seemed like to me. Also, I'm sorry for asking that question.
No.
Which two cities did she? How does she have own two cities
and also realms?
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. She traveled a good deal.
Oh,
she lived in Brazil for
I know there was like
15 years or something. Okay. So I think, and she lived in other parts for long, long stretches of time. So yeah, I think it's poetic license to say she owned them. Yes, Max. Sorry.
Could you go to the
sure. Yep.
Is a villanelle set in that format?
Yes. I mean, people can play with them and manipulate them a little bit, and still it'd still be called a villanelle, but this is the form of a villanelle, yes.
So like a sonnet, a set form?
Yep, exactly.
Like, who invented it? I mean, who invents forms?
It's Italian in its origin. You can hear that in the name, yeah. And no Italian forms still remain. The earliest villanelles we have are French.
Oh, really?
There's one about a turtle that was like the equivalent of a pop song. It became so popular back in the day. But They think its roots might be in like farming tasks. Huh. So tying sheaves or some kind of repetitive task that people would do together. Huh. That's where they imagine the roots came from. Because Villanelle is connected to the word village, huh. Like a village song. Huh. Or a villa, right? Yes, Francis.
I'm wondering, I might just be making too much of this or just looking for maybe somewhere, but the places, Anna, that you said that she plays around with the form, like with the iambic pentameter plus, like she has like the 11th syllable in there, and that she monkeys, like those lines aren't exactly the same. She
misses
a little bit. Like there's even something in that to me as you're talking so much about the boundedness of the form and trying to find grief. There's something to me where I think of like in the ways that like the form isn't quite as tight.
Yeah, it like squeaks out. Really
it's like there's something in that too of grief of like even it's like it's like pressing a beach ball under the water and holding it down. You know, it's like it actually can't be contained in that way.
So good, yeah.
I don't know if that is intentional on her part or not, but I sort of feel that.
Okay.
Yeah, like just following up on that, so to speak, like volleyball. There's poetry that that seems to happen like right after the moment of grief occurs, and then due to this complexity, I have to imagine this happened long after all the griefs, and like they still affect her because there's still impurities, like they still affect her.
Yeah.
But I imagine like this wasn't like. This just happened. I now have this really complex poetry expression. You know, like there was clearly time that needed to be taken.
Yeah.
In space.
See, the irony, I mean, master is the sense of grasp, and losing is the exact opposite.
Opposite
thing. You've mastered. And then I wonder, like, if this, like, you're just wondering how long she's going to hold on to this master language. And then at the end there, Not too hard. That little two is like a little, okay, maybe, I don't know what I'm talking about.
That's good. Juan?
The imperative at the end, is that for her or is it for us?
I think it's for her.
Yeah, I think it's for her, but that's an interesting question. Huh. We better write it. Yeah, this whole, I think you feel that it kind of falls apart here, even though it doesn't. This dash, that's not usually a part of a villanelle. It kind of disrupts its cadence.
Yeah.
And then she's got two sets of parentheses. Mm. It's like her other thoughts somehow get like coming in. She's not mastering it. They're coming in and saying other things.
True.
What do you guys think of the use of the word art, or even that she calls it one art? Judy, yeah.
Ask what you think she thought would be a disaster. Has she written about a disaster?
Because it's like none of this was a disaster.
Yeah,
that's a great question. Did everyone hear that? She said, well, what is a disaster then?
If none of this
none
is.
Of this is.
But don't you think that's the irony in this poem?
Yeah.
Like, all of these things are disasters.
Yes.
And so this is like, I'm gonna make it. It's okay.
It's not a disaster.
Like this is the self-talk of like I have to get up. I still have to get out of bed.
Yeah.
It you know, and that last line I think is what drives it home.
Yeah.
Like it doesn't just look like a disaster.
Very
it's hard enough to say that it looks like a disaster because she has to command herself to do it.
Yeah. She kind of fools you at the beginning. You're like, oh yeah, it's boss door keys. No big deal. It's like she kind of ropes you in, but it's no big deal, no disaster. And then you're like, wait a second, yes it is. Yes, I think you were next.
I took it to mean at the end, she knows she's going to get over it. That everything, even though it felt like a disaster at the time, became a memory, it became less painful.
Hmm.
And I think she's saying, I mean, the way I took it, she knows it's very painful now, but she's almost a little bit sad that her loss of her mate is going to fade into the background and not be identical to losing the car key, but it's not going to have the emotional impact.
Mm-hmm.
So it won't be a disaster, and since her life didn't end, her life is going to go on.
Mm.
And she's all, and it's the way I took it.
Mm. But it has kind of a lighthearted feel,
yes.
The way she wrote it, which I think is very ironic and intentionally.
Which is, to me, that's that to me, she knows it's going to be lighthearted even...
Eventually, if you think?
Well, lighter-hearted. Hmm. Maybe I'm wrong, but... Hmm. Yeah.
Yes, Dick.
Yeah, I think she starts out just with the art of losing is an art to master. Total irony. But then she, it's as if she's saying, I'll work on this and work from little ones to bigger ones and it'll be all the same. One art.
There you go.
It's all one thing. Losing the keys is just not, it's not different. Then she gets to the end and I think she just hits the wall entirely in the last whole stanza. Mm-hmm. And she's pretending, and it's loaded with qualification.
Yeah, yeah.
Isn't it? Not too hard to master. May look like
right.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You know, it's. I think she just says it. She's showing it. I've tried to do one right, and I'm not making it.
Yeah, I didn't tell you a very key piece of information about her life because I thought it might ruin, but. Her partner of a very, very long time committed suicide. And so I think that's mm-hmm. very perceptive as to what's going on when she hits this last stanza. Yeah. There were some other hands. I just kind of dropped a bomb. Sorry. But yes. Oh, sorry, Juan.
I got stuck with the writing.
Yeah.
Her way of finally saying that she's not denying it as she does in the other ones, right? She's just staying with it. It may look like, but she doesn't say that it's not, mm-hmm. as she does on the other ones. Mm-hmm. And she doesn't want to say it that it's not. So she, I think that the right is like, write it, like sort of like recognize that it sort of is.
Yeah.
And also, the question about art is. Like the look, like I think it's making a reference to that. Finally, what the art is. Mm-hmm. Like, it looks like a mess, but I think that she's trying to remember the good things. I think, and how valuable they were. Or, I guess like loss makes her realize that of this joking voice or the gesture that she liked, but perhaps she loved it.
Thank you. Were you going to say something, Dan? Okay. Yes.
You know, it is interesting. I love working with grief. I've worked for many years, and it seems like the more griefs a person has, the more compounded they get. And so I'm just wondering if you see something like that going on here in the poem.
It's compounding?
Where there's a compounding, like... And master some realms I owned.
Yeah.
I lost two cities. Like, do you see like an expansion going on? Like, this is getting more and more difficult.
Yeah. I think that's a good word. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think it does seem to expand. Maybe expand and then contract to this one person. Mm-hmm. It expands to, yeah, these realms. Yeah, I think that's a good point.
So this is like the crowning loss. That
yes, absolutely.
And all these other losses.
Yeah. So you're kind of reading it backwards. You think that crowning loss helped her see all the other losses?
I'm not sure if you would want to say it helps, but it doesn't necessarily feel like.
Yeah.
Like it in the process of like when everything just all feels like it's out.
Yeah.
I guess you could say help from the perspective of processing the pain and the experiences. Mm-hmm. It feels uncontainable, I think.
And I agree with you. And I think it's amazing that that's what it feels like, and this is what she does with it. She puts these boundaries on it. As we've said, it seems to kind of leak out and kind of fall apart or dissolve.
So you would actually say, like the Book of Job, I think the Hebrew gets more and more chaotic towards the end of the Book of Job, if I'm not mistaken. Is it that way in Job?
We'd have to ask some people who know more Hebrew than I.
Well, it plays with us. His friends so off, they drive him to greater and greater stupidities of things he's claiming for himself. In order to refute them, mm-hmm. they back him into a corner saying mm-hmm. more and more unrealistic things about his own righteousness. But basically, at the end, you have God speaking, bringing you out of the whole thing, and, or bringing Job, understanding of Job mm-hmm. and understanding of God. So it certainly doesn't end in a chaotic mm-hmm. thing. It ends up with the voice of God, who's been referenced in every almost every verse,
yeah.
but hasn't put in an appearance since chapter one.
I just I'm wondering if I'm getting it wrong, but there's one book in the Old Testament where the Hebrew does kind of seem to just like, get more and more chaotic. Anyway,
I don't know.
I don't know.
Probably there'd be some songs that would do that.
Yeah, Lamentations. Mm-hmm. The Lamentations is made up of 5 acrostics. And there is, I have read commentary of a sort of dissolving that happens mm-hmm. in the last acrostic. Is that familiar to you? I don't remember exactly what it was, but it is something of a change that looks like falling apart at the end. Yeah, I have definitely read that.
My comment was really, like, so what you're saying is the irony is in the form itself.
Yes, I think so.
Bound.
But I also think, yes,
highly,
I think...
Measured.
Yes, strict, tight reins. And I think it kind of bursts out, but mm-hmm. I still think there's something to be learned. I think there's something good, actually, in giving boundaries to our grief. That mm-hmm. in that practice, we are doing something wise to say, okay, you don't get to just take over my life. It's a way to practice putting boundaries on what threatens to take over. Yes, Kai, and then Dana.
Was she depressed? Did she deal with depression?
I don't know. I don't know. I couldn't speak to that specifically.
Right.
Yeah. Danny?
It's going to be back to the concept of construct.
Yeah.
And shape. So I've been thinking kind of, a lot of this is like repetition, and at least ideas of repetition.
Mm-hmm.
And so it makes me think a lot of, I think you think of 2 things. You think of like the music of Bach,
yeah.
which is like highly ordered.
Okay.
But there's something so gratifying about it. Like mm-hmm. no one's ever like, well, should have done this and this, this to be more expressive, mm-hmm. you know, but there's so much emotion in the order.
Yes.
I think that's just like a very cathartic thing
yes.
for someone who needs comfort.
yes.
And then the other thing that came to mind was the music of Arthur Pärt.
Mm-hmm.
And very minimal in his later years music, and how even the this like clockwork structure of his music provides this solace
yes.
To his listeners, even if and it's in a minor key almost all the time, and it's there's something strange about the human heart and the human mind that like structure, and it gives space to be feeling and thinking things, but also sort of surrounds it.
Yeah, you don't have, there's no anxiety about what could come, mm-hmm. because you know full well what's going to come mm-hmm. when there are those kind of structures on it. Yes, thank you so much for saying that. I love that. Mm-hmm. I think that's absolutely right. Yes. Go ahead.
I was just thinking about, like, I have tried to write villanelles and working with these really tight forms, there's also something where it's like, you're already given something,
mm-hmm.
and when you know you have a few lines or a few words that you want to meditate on,
mm-hmm.
like they kind of walk into these places in the poem, but then there's this space between them that opens up, and so like that kind of functions as this. Okay, I don't actually know what's going to come out between these words,
yeah.
but at least these words can sort of be these anchor points. And so I think, even kind of wedding the creative process with the grieving process
yes.
here, like it provides a safety of who knows what she experienced when she wrote this, but that, you know, I think like one of the reasons we write poems is because we don't know what to say, and we don't know how to say what we want to say.
Yeah.
You know, and so there's something to trying.
Yes.
To say it.
Yes.
Yeah, and then even, I don't know, maybe because she's commanding herself to write what she doesn't want to write at the end of the poem, you know, it's, you get this sense of she's discovering what
yes.
she needs to say.
Yeah.
She didn't know before, you know, and she can come to that through this.
Yeah. Some of you might know Tennyson's poem In Memoriam, which is kind of the most famous, well, recent-ish English elegy, grieving the death of his dear friend, Halem. And it's not in Memoriam, but I was telling you about the stick. This friend that he wrote that for made a comment at some point, I think he was a poet too, talking about basically what happens in a more abstract way with rhyme, how we encounter rhyme. And he was talking about this relationship between memory and hope. So when we're like on our way to finishing a rhyme in a poem, like knowing what to anticipate, what's coming, we're hoping for it, it also connects us to the memory of the first rhyme. And that inside lines where there's a rhyme before and a rhyme after, it's like this safe place where you have both memory and hope. I thought that was really beautiful. Mm-hmm. Really good. Yes, Max.
In the same vein of repetition and also the harking back to some of the poetry in the Old Testament, I'm very much reminded of Ecclesiastes, where Solomon is sort of, he's discovering that the sum total of all of his toil and all of his wisdom is ultimately meaningful.
Mm.
He even says it's a great evil that we work all of our lives, you know, just to leave it to somebody else. And in the same way, in her first stanza, she says so many things seem filled with the intent to be lost, or that they're lost in a disaster. She's sort of identifying that really life itself is this perpetual cycle of having things and then losing them.
Yeah.
And, you know, she goes farther, you know, naming things that are more and more important to her, things that are more and more grandiose, and but you can lose even this and acquire this and still even lose it.
Yeah. Yeah. I think we'll hear more about Ecclesiastes next week, am I right? That's good. Yes, Marty.
The first sentence of the second line, lose something every day, is that like an imperative?
Yeah.
Telling us, lose something
practice
every day
it.
On purpose, kind of to get used to it? I mean,
it seems like it, yeah.
Practice up.
Spiritual practice.
Practice it.
Yeah,
practice it.
Spiritual discipline.
Some of us don't need to try.
Yeah, exactly. And she even gives us evidence that we don't need to try.
Yeah,
it's coming.
The things try to lose themselves.
Yeah. They seem filled with the intent to be lost.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yes?
Do you have any idea, like, what her worldview paradigm is?
No. Not so much. Does anyone know more about Elizabeth Bishop? I don't know what her... I mean, I don't know that she had any religious affiliation. What's that?
A lot of people guess.
Yeah.
And certainly...
I really don't know. I haven't read a biography on her or anything like that. Something to look into. Yes?
Just the point that Danny made about comparing structured music... I just thought of the opposite and how very chaotic, unstructured chance music, you know, what's his name, Page, was it? John Page. And it is so unsettling, it's at least to me.
Hmm.
So, you know, we had a friend who was sort of one of the developers of microtonal music, which isn't quite the same, because there can be some structure in that, but very unstructured music, just... makes me feel like I'm coming apart. And so you can it's just no place to rest. There's no peace or solace. And
yes.
So you can see how, you know, thinking about that in music, and then, and again,
the exact opposite
like
in
this,
here.
Yeah,
yeah, exactly. Although it's interesting, it's super structured, and yet I still think it gives you some sense of it falling apart.
Yeah,
at the end,
I
which
think
is
so too. I think that
amazing.
Last stanza is great.
Yeah.
I shan't have lied. Oh, really?
I know.
Yeah.
I know.
You're not lying?
It's great.
Well, even the syntax there is confusing. Like, is that a sentence?
I know.
Even losing you, a parenthetical, I shan't have lied. Like, they're fragments.
Yeah, yeah. Right, right.
Yep, so you break them down.
Okay,
well. Like that, well, okay. Lose something every day is an imperative. Accept the fluster. Like, I think it's purposeful that
that's on the same line.
There. Yeah. I mean, it's accept the fluster of lost door keys, but it's more than that. It's like, learn to accept the fluster. At first, it's kind of like, well, yeah, we lose stuff all the time. We don't have to practice losing. And so at first, you're like, okay, maybe.
I can go with this.
We lose stuff all the time. And then it gets deeper, and you're like, wait, this advice breaks down. And,
so good, yeah.
I mean, there's even an irony in the whole idea of giving advice.
That she's giving advice?
Right. That's just not usually what you want to do.
He's experiencing loss, yeah. Yeah, these commands. Lose something every day. Just accept it. You're right. Okay, shall we move on to our last poem? This poem's a little bit longer, not terribly long, just to prepare you. It's called Given. Offered to our community before it was trashed, as if dared to want you. Richard brought a sample cushion to our meeting, certain that no one would claim a red monstrosity from IKEA, no less. He warned, you would take up a room like a giant, wearing all corduroy in the corner with legs stretched out, almost touching the opposite wall. We said yes. With a few chewed edges, evidence of some creature's delight in you, we welcomed you into our space, the dark-walled rooms where we pieced you together. We were surgeons in the OR. We found a part missing and made do. That's when you seemed to me like another LaBrie student. You wandered in from who knows where, a little damaged but with a glow all your own, bearing the stains of your first home, bearing them forgivingly, generous in the way you held the less than careful from your past, like a kind-hearted grandma who has known generations and still can laugh, like a gift I hadn't asked for, a perpetual holiday in our living room. I still say one day I will choose my very own couch, one that fits the room it's in, intended, as funky as I like. I won't pay heed to the price tag. I will tell the delivery men to place it just so, under the bay window or beside the fireplace or by the wall of books, and I will clap my hands in delight when I see it there. But I will also remember you on that day, and I will be thankful for the early mornings with Dave, steaming coffee and our hearts brimming cozy, for soggy tissues tucked in every crease by tearful students gathering Fiona hair, the movies watched while snuggling my growing sons, the poems written and read aloud on your every surface, and quiet piles of friends beside me as we together listened to tales from Mars, from Mowgli's jungle, from Lucy's Narnia, and Sherlock's rooms on Baker Street. Awesome. Maybe you don't want to reread the whole thing. I don't know. It's big. This is a living poet as well. Talk about a big chunk taking up the whole page. It looks more like prose. This poet might not be great with the absences yet. I'm sharing this poem not to say, look at me, I wrote a poem, isn't it great? But as an invitation This is a regular person's poem. This helped me say goodbye to our couch. That's what the whole thing is about. I hope that that came through. It's about a big old red couch. But more than that, a whole season of life. All the life that had been lived on this couch for the years that it was ours. I picked this one, as I said, as an invitation just to kind of show regular Joe's poem and to invite you to consider writing down some of your loss. This is what poets do. They show a creative dominion that each of us has been given over the page, over these words, over our experiences, and to practice a sort of creative defiance in light of our grief and our losses, I think is particularly healing. To say, I'm going to make something, though I feel unmade about this thing, though it's just a couch. It represents more than that. We are acting out our image of godness when we do this. This kind of creative defiance of making something, some kind of creative endeavor with the grief that we're experiencing, with the losses that we've known. It reminds me of another Wendell Berry poem, his Mad Farmer Liberation Front, which you're probably familiar with if you know Wendell Berry. He has a great line in there that says, "Be joyful, though you have considered all the facts." And I think of that in terms of writing a poem with the losses we encounter. Write a poem, though you have considered all the facts. I know this is kind of a hopeful move in this lecture, and I want to do that carefully. I know some people are carrying losses that go much deeper than a couch. And I was so helped by Dave's Bible study he led here a couple weeks ago, or just last week. He was talking about Psalm 13 that starts with, "How long, O Lord?" and ends with, "I will sing the Lord's praise." And sometimes we forget that that poem may have taken a very long time to write. So maybe the first or the last two lines, the really hopeful lines that are kind of moving forward in faith and in hope, took a long time to get to that point. So even as I encourage you to potentially write down your own losses, I recognize you might not quite be at that point yet, depending on the sorrow you're encountering. Is there anything you want to talk about in this poem? I just have a couple kind of closing things, but I'm happy to talk about it. What's that?
What was the title?
Given. I also want to be careful not to say, like, you need to take your grief and put it to work. Get it on a poem. Get it in a poem. I don't think that's what I'm advising so much as another psalm that comes to mind that talks about, Psalm 56 talks about God recording our miseries and actually collecting our tears in bottles. Yeah. I love that psalm, Psalm 56:8. And that's a bit of what I was trying to do here, is kind of record a bit of sadness, a bit of misery. And if God is doing that, how much more can we? Yes.
I just want to thank you for the reminder that poetry can happen here, like with us in the day to day. It's easy to put it away from you and be like, "Oh, that's art on the wall that I can't participate in." But like, you know, I was like, you know, I was looking at this, okay, and like Labrie, I'm like, okay, and then like these were, and suddenly there were names that I recognized, and I was like, it's you know, it took me like a long time to figure it out, but that's how poetry is, you know, it's us as well as art.
I hope this isn't offensive at all, a little damaged, but with a glow all your own. I'm talking about myself, too. I came to Labrie as a student, first of all. Yes.
I like the way furniture is talked about
it just exudes a sense of hospitality, of warmth, of a contrast to sort of Better Homes and Gardens magazine picture of the perfect where everything
is just
perfect. I sort of picture, you know, white walls and stainless steel and just no clutter and no magazines on the table and nothing like that. And it's such a different picture, which really, I think, communicates what Le Brie is, what your life has been and is, and what Le Brie is. And really, in a wonderful way.
Yes.
I too have only ever read the chapters that I've been given.
One day.
And I love that the one, I still say, one day, I will choose my very own chapter, that finds a place in this poem too. Mm-hmm. And the, I think even what you're describing about memory and hope and kind of the connection here between saying goodbye by deeply accepting what you have been given.
Yes.
And then also how that, like, there's still longing.
Yeah.
You know, for what might be. Yeah. The couch that you may have someday. I don't know if you want to say anything more about that, but I think the, I guess that thinking about longing as absences too, you know, like we long for what we don't have yet.
Yes, I think that was very much at work in this poem, wanting to say this had been given, it was a good gift, I can recognize so many wonderful things about it, but it's not quite perfect, like everything, right? There's a sense of, it was given, I'm thankful, I have wonderful memories with it, but it was this monstrosity that everybody was like, why do you have this in your living room? I was like, it's so great, it's very bright, but it's great. So it's kind of, I was definitely struggling with the imperfections of things being given and yet their giftedness and the goodness that can still be found in them when they're not ideal and I didn't choose them. I didn't go and say, I want this, which is what life is like in so many realms. Yes.
We had a weird experience when we lived in London. We worked with Le Brie. We had a church in our home. Dick was pastor of the church. The home belonged to Le Brie.
Mm-hmm.
We went away on vacation, and we came back, and some people in the church had taken it upon themselves to paint our living room and cover a sofa.
Oh, no.
It was just horrible.
Not your taste.
Red, you know, fabric that was everything stuck to it, and bright yellow walls and a red sofa. And it was so awful. It was really awful because I just couldn't sit in that room. It was our living room. Like, I thought, here, Richard did ask you.
He did. He was kind of like, does anybody want this?
But you had the warning. You didn't go on vacation and come home and find your home.
That's great.
Hard-working, sacrificial people.
What a wonderful thing for us.
That's great.
It was really hard to be
back. Did you send a thank you note?
The church was in our house. They came to our house every week. They got to sit in the living room. I was...
Yes, Mary Frances.
Just that same part. I mean, Richard brought a sample cushion to our meetings for no one to play for, I partially love that because I know Richard. I can just like see his face and hear the tone in his voice, which is like perfect. But I like totally hear that.
Yeah.
But I think there's also something too in this thing that it's like that has been rejected, right? This thing has had so many iterations that it's now at the point that it's been given away for free, and not expected that even then would it be wanted.
Yes.
So you kind of start with that, and then you have this beautiful picture of the life that it has not brought, of course, but has accompanied.
It's nurtured,
Nurtured and borne witness to, which I love just the contrast of those two.
Mm. Yes, thanks for singing that. Yes, Danny.
I really appreciate going back to the word given. Mm-hmm. Just thinking about grief and loss, and this can vary, but I, in my own grief and loss and lament, much of my problem letting go is saying, this wasn't mine to begin with. And so just thinking about thinking of things being given to you as opposed to being entitled to,
right?
And so, you know, that's, I think that that's sort of part of the lamenting process or grieving process.
Yes.
Of releasing of ownership. Mm-hmm. And I guess like that title is really apt for loss in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I felt like there was a. Yes, the letting go is a really is a, such a good image, but there to me the word that came to me was like there was a shepherding happening for this loss. I felt like I was being shepherded through this loss and all the losses of really like a whole season and this whole kind of, you know, dreamed up life of living in the Alps in this chalet, and I was being shepherded through it, and then I was also being asked to shepherd this sorrow. And poetry has been a helpful way for me to do that, to try and like be a shepherd of my own sorrow, my own having to let go of things and release them to the good shepherd.
It's beautiful the way that you preserve the memory and the story tied to an object. So even though the object is no longer here, like, it still tells a story.
Thank you. Yes?
Just to kind of notice from the last one, it seems, you know, in the last one there's almost an emphasis on kind of stiff upper lip, just kind of don't look back.
Yeah.
And this forces you to look back.
Yeah. I don't have a stiff upper lip in this.
No, I mean, that's such a striking difference between the two, partly through something, you have to delight in what it was you lost. It almost reminds me of at a funeral, there can be such positive, beautiful moments when you hear stories about the person you've lost. There's another side to the grief, and it's a chance to be grateful as well.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's good. Thank you. Mary Frances, you were kind of noting how kind of junked up it was, or kind of, and it was quite chewed up by some kind of animal. I don't know what. It was a dog or a cat on all kinds of corners. And that was a part of this too, and something I would offer to you or ask you even to consider that, I mean, we were trying to make something, like make a life in our living room with this chewed up thing, but I even think of writing poems like this that I have these kind of raw materials, and when you're talking about your loss or your griefs or your sorrows, they feel like kind of really messed up things you have to work with. But then shepherding them into something hopefully good or creative or that has a beauty to it is such a redemptive process too, to try and take these raw materials and make something good, which is exactly what our deepest and greatest hope is, that that's what God will do with the things we've lost, with the griefs we've known, with the brokenness we've encountered, that he will take these raw materials and make a poem, I mean, make something good, make something beautiful with the chewed up edges of our lives. Yes, Marty.
Thank you, that's very helpful. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking of another of a contrast. When I was working on a lecture on hospitality, I came across a quote from an administrator or president of a seminary commenting on the fact that the carpet in this main room was a little frayed. And his comment was, how dishonoring to the Lord.
Oh,
and I just thought, the fact that we must do something, we must spend thousands of dollars and replace this carpet, it's a little bit frayed. I thought, what a contrast to your hospitality.
Yeah.
And what that you're saying, the Shakers used to say that you know, all their wedding presents were broken within several years of having LaBrie.
Yep.
Chipped or broken.
Yep.
Because of hospitality, because yeah. of welcoming people into their homes.
Yeah.
And
who
is
it?
What is more
yeah.
honoring to God? Having yeah. a perfect carpet? Or having welcoming people into your home and
yeah.
dealing with the bearing the stains of the
tree. Yeah. And recognizing the frayed edges yeah. of our lives, and God still loves us and is making something beautiful out of the frayed edges. Mm-hmm. So, yes, Alyssa, and then we'll close up.
I just love how the text on that page just feels like a monstrosity itself.
That's so true.
Like, I feel like if I was to hold up my hands, I would feel the weight of it. So it's interesting that it starts small and then it gets, you know, kind of slides out. So it feels like I'm holding it and it's sliding out. And so it's like the idea that like this heavy presence is now like you're giving raw material back. Mm.
That's beautiful.
Good.
Let it slide back through your fingers. So, just my very last comment. In your own losses, your own griefs, it could be time for you to handle the absence you're living with by making something present. Practice putting boundaries on your grief. And practice some creative dominion, endeavoring to shepherd your sorrows into something new. That is what I will leave you with. Thank you guys for all your great comments.
Thank you. Bye.
Also this, if you're really interested in more poems along these lines, of course there's a ton. This is a whole book of poems by Malcolm Guite. They're not all by him, some are, but it's a whole book on grief, loss, lament, and hope. It's called Love, Remember. These are all individual poems. And this is the one I mentioned about his son mm-hmm. who died. And then this is the one that I quoted. This isn't really about loss, but in case you wanted to know, the one of Be Joyful Though You Have Considered All the Facts. It comes from that poem. So, if you'd like that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Thank you so much.
Yes, you brought your book,
okay? If you,
right here.
If you, I'm going to leave this with you.
Oh, sorry, one second.